on the alt fan Frank Zappa, I announced that we were going to do the Zappa Hour a couple of days ago, and somebody called the old geezer said, well, hasn't everything been said about Frank that could be said? And yes, for the little people, probably everything's been said. But I told them, no, we are going to present a new aspect, a new way of looking at Frank that's never been said before. So that's our challenge, Roxy, to prove that prediction by me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to mute everybody, and we're going to play John Adams as the opening statement appropriate to Frank Zappa and everybody that's written about him. So mute everybody, then I'll gradually unmute people to bring them in. But at first, it'll just be Roxy and I. Okay, mute all.
All participants are now muted.
And bring on John Adams. Okay, and he's right here in the template. Bill put him in for me. And this is like 3.5 minutes long. So here is John Adams, prominent American composer, being interviewed in 2009 in, you know, some place like the Lincoln Center or something. They're probably presenting his music. Oh, by the way, well, maybe not. Alyssa is asking who is Corbin. Corbin's a longtime participant, alcoholic, drug taker, heroin addict, Crowleyite, fuck up. And also, he has a great alibi. His father was involved in the Kennedy assassination, so the FBI followed Corbin ever since he was a kid. So Corbin has, as you see, Gene just pointing that out. Alyssa, Corbin has a great alibi for his early intuitions of sort of screwed up quadrophenia. But he's learning just to get it together. So here goes John Adams.
Fora TV, the world is thinking.
I mean, I think that the great bifurcation in music is between pop and classical. And I talk quite a bit about it in the book, about what it's like to be a classical composer in a society where popular music and popular culture in general has enormous prestige. You know, you can't run for office without saying how much you like, you know, Kanye West or, you know, Willie Nelson or something. And, you know, if Barack Obama or John Kerry, God forbid, had said that they liked Beethoven, that would, their poll numbers would have dropped through the floor, because this country is so, we have this suspicion about culture that there's something vaguely subversive and morally lax about art. And so that's why we really glorify pop culture. And it's all part of our, you know, we were a country that was founded by religious zealots and venture capitalists. You know, which is basically what the Puritans were, and the first colonists. So that lingering anti-intellectualism has great presence in America, and we composers and poets and serious novelists, we have to cope with that, and we have to find a way to sort of navigate through the shoals of an. You know, a culture of who are, on one hand, really a genuinely would love to know, would love to be initiated, would love to get access to what it is we're thinking about, but at the same time are sort of a little bit intimidated. And whenever they look at the media, they never get anything. I mean, I don't know about you, but we get 120 channels on our cable, and there's nothing, absolutely nothing on any of them that has anything to do with our life. You know, you never see a poet. You never see a classical musician. You might see a sautéed kidney, you know, on NPR cook show or some masterpiece theater with a British accent, but that qualifies as culture. And so it's quite an experience to try to create great art in this culture. On the other hand, I wouldn't trade any other country for it.
Okay, so that's John Adams in about 2009. Now I have
all participants are now unmuted.
Which column is Roxy coming through? Could you speak, Roxy, so I can see where the red flash is?
Here.
And where you are. Or where you are.
I'm here.
Okay. Is that you? Right there? Okay. Okay, I think I will click around it. Mute everybody around it. Say hello, Roxy, to make sure I got it.
Hey, Zappa, we are here.
Yes. Okay, so I've got the right. Now, yes. Now, what do you think of what John Adams just said? Do you see the relevance of his what he says to the Zappa topic, Zappa series, Zappa world?
Well, that's very important in the Zappa world because Zappa, like Mozart, thought people were giving only bad music. They never had the chance to listen to more complicated music because people that has the power to control the media thought that's too complex, that doesn't appeal to people, it doesn't have any commercial value. And Zappa said, let them decide. He was never aired. It was really word of mouth how he became famous. And like Mozart was also trying to bring his music to a popular audience. He didn't want it only to play for the kings. He wanted everybody to listen to good music. And that was a big fight all his life. Just to, like Joyce, he had to face a lot of censorship just to do what he wanted to do, to have the freedom to present the music he wanted to present without dumbing himself down.
That's pretty interesting. Did you see Amadeus, that movie on Mozart, 20, 30 years ago?
Yes, a long time ago.
Yeah. Now, the establishment guy, Santorini or somebody, who would he represent? Leonard Bernstein or something in Zappa's day? Remember, he was the establishment. He suppressed Mozart as much as he could. You remember that guy, the evil guy in the movie? How it was presented, anyways?
Salieri, other composer?
Yeah, the other composer. I don't know what. Yes.
Salieri.
I forget his name. Right.
Yeah.
And so,
at least during that time, Mozart had the same problem as Zappa because he was being too innovative. He would play too many notes, they would say, or he was doing things in German, not only in Italian. And at the time, even the greatest composer was treated as a servant. He was just a servant for the court, and he decided to take his music and to be his own manager and to produce his own concerts and print his music and do all the producing of the operas. And that's what Zappa also had to do, because otherwise they could not have done what they did, these amazing works.
Mm. Okay, so what I hear is,
right there. Did you learn that as a 10-year-old about Mozart or 20? How early were you taught that fact about Mozart in your musical education?
Well, I suppose I was in the conservatory and you get some history of music classes. Maybe when I was like 9.
They would talk about Mozart being an outsider. You remember that?
Yes.
Mm.
Yes,
okay.
Because he really changed everything. this is what William Lewis said. The artist has to feed the vortex because that's what makes this vortex move and evolve. And before, there were very strict laws for composition. And also the church had the control of most of what was being created in the arts, in the paintings and in the music. And they had very strict laws of what was allowed or not. And some intervals would be called even like evil. That, like, there were things that you were not supposed to do, and the people who dared to break those rules really faced a lot of censorship.
Mm. Do you know what it was about the tonalities of what was censored? Would you project a Freudian interpretation on that? Well, what were, do you know why they were against certain tonalities?
Because they said there were like consonants and dissonants. And the consonant harmonies are good, and the dissonant intervals may be evil. You know, they will relate it with something bad.
And, now, did I just fade out? I think I noticed that I moved. Did you notice that? Did I fade out? Okay. I'm still here. You can hear me, right?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think that the leveling of sound depth by the effect of the printing press is partly what the industrial symphony orchestras were subject to? That their ears became tinnier, and they wanted smoothness, what McLuhan called in prose equitone. They wanted equitone, whereas medieval music might be richer in the level of tones and not as suppressed, or does it happen before the printing press, what you're talking about?
No, that was in the medieval time. But I think the writing of music and then the printing press really influenced the way compositions were made, and the harmony and how things were structured.
They made new rules?
Yes, I think it affects how you organize your thinking when you make like a phrase, when you write it down, as when you are just like just improvising or singing like in a tribe.
You're saying that you're not improvising. You said you're not improvising.
Yes,
is that what you just said?
Music before, I think, writing was more like to create a trance or more ritual, more aesthetic.
Yes.
And then the labyrinth of the mind got in, and things were more rational, more mathematic. Like, if you hear Bach, it's really pure mathematics. And there is a sense of order and structure. It's not just like
for the
chaotic
eye.
Ritual.
Yeah, for the eye.
And also the linear, you know, it's not just this acoustic chaos.
Yeah.
It has like a start and develops, and then it finished, but they were forms, structures, patterns that people will use to compose.
Right. Is the fugue something that is a response to the linear print effect on music, or was the fugue something before the printing press?
The art of the fugue is really developed during Bach time.
Okay.
He has this treaty about the fugue. And I think it has to do a lot with the fact that music is written and printed. This type of very rational organization of the melodies and the harmonies.
Okay. Now, I want to go back to John Adams. So he's saying there's a big divide between classical music and pop music. And this was a divide that C.S. Lewis, when he wrote about in the 50s, the two cultures, this British essayist, and he said that the problem was that the scientists were battling the humanists over culture. And he said Wyndham Lewis was wrong to ignore that division. So Lewis was one of the first people, actually Don Thiel would say the first person, to bring in pop culture into high culture in his analysis of what was going on in the art world in the teens and 20s. So we know that Zappa did that. So John Adams is saying, and working from this division, C.S. Lewis, initial C.S. So he's an C.S. Lewisite, saying the two will never meet, and it's a conflict, whereas Zappa is a Wyndham Lewisite. You got two Lewises there, a Wyndham Lewisite, who allows pop culture to come into his compositional ideas. So John Adams is respected because he's hoiking up the classical difference, and he has a big problem with pop culture, and he becomes, to me, a boring commentator, because that's 2009, and just the web changes music and alters everything for composers, and he's still living in the ivory tower. Did you see that in what he was saying? He's the exact opposite of Zappa?
Yes, because these composers were trying to appeal a public, or, for example, write music for Hollywood movies or make some type of career, and their motivation was not only the music, but like Zappa was always making fun, wearing this only for the money.
Yeah. So you're saying that Zappa represents those composers that wanted to work with Hollywood? Is that what you just said?
No, the opposite. These other composers, like Adams, for many contemporary composers, making film music was like a goal, because it was like a way, an opportunity to present their work to a broader audience and still be artistic in a way.
Right. Yeah. Because movies let me just say, the second half of the century, movies as a medium became archetypal. It replaced the novel as the, you know, sensitive presentation under the auteur theory of the director is presenting something. Robert Altman, people like that, they're doing great works. So the artist no longer is in the book culture, and the composer is no longer in the book culture. He can at least go to the movie culture as opposed to TV and radio, rock and roll. Is that what you're saying? The archetypalness of the movie medium.
Yes, and we are bombarded by the whole environment, so it's impossible to separate your influence as an artist, and just to be influenced by high art. You're bombarded by comics and everything. And I think it's very important to mention that one of the things that turned on Zappa into music was a piece called Ionization by Varese.
Varese.
What a coincidence.
Yes, the ionization.
Ionization.
Now, he's 15, he hears that, and he's intrigued by the percussion and the sounds, and he writes a lot about it. He funds later recreations of it, you know, conducted by him or other people. Are talking here from the perspective, for those in the Zappa world who don't know what I've been doing, is that we have evoked a new song via a phenomenon, a new environment called Ion. And so we've made a lot out of Ion the last 6 years, and Roxy's pointing out that Zappa, his first inspiration as a young imaginative person was something called ionization. And so for Roxy and I and others here, that is a great synchronicity and maybe even a synchrony that Zappa is testing his buddies in high school on how they respond to ionization. Well, that's what we do here on this Saturday night show called Payday. We test people's responses to ionization and all that it means. But we're not going to go into that in detail. We're going to stay with Zappa, but this is what Roxy's getting at. So now, Roxy, what you see this John Adams. Okay, go ahead.
But what I wanted to say is, in his early teens, he was aware of the avant-garde of contemporary music, but he was also into this Mexican Pachucos music. The Pachucos is like a tribe in LA that were like the modern Mexicans, the immigrants that were trying to become Americans, but they had their own slang, their own music, their own styles, a little like the hip hop now. And Zappa would listen to that. He would listen to contemporary music he was influenced also by jazz and by everything. He never made this strict separation of this is high culture and this is not. He will only see the interesting music in everything, in ideas.
Yeah, did you? Hey, Roxy, I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Were the Zoot Suiters part of the Mexican Pachuco culture? Do you know about the Zoot Suiters in the 40s?
Yes, I think they were.
Okay, so that's part of what... and are you saying Mexican Pachuco is what we call R&B, or is that something different?
No, it's something different. It was a type of jazzy swing... Like these Mexicans trying to be American, but they had still their own Mexican influence.
Right.
Their own thing going on. And that was one
and,
of
you know,
the
he
things
may- And I want to begin with the Uncle Meat movie.
Yes.
In the Uncle Meat movie... In the late 60s, he has Uncle Meat, you know, hijacking these Mexican Pachuco singers. That's actually his theme. So I have not heard people talk about that in Zappa World, the Pachuco culture too much. But you're saying you can hear that in Frank?
No, I think he even talks about that.
He does talk about the Pachuco rockers, but not... I'm not sure what he meant. He just is in passing, not in any detail that I know of. But did you have Pachuco influences in your life in Mexico City?
Well, there was a very famous actor called Tintan that he was like a comedian that made this Pachuco thing popular in Mexico in the 40s and in the 50s.
Okay. And you would know that as a kid growing up, or you would have to, growing up in the 70s and 80s, or was it long forgotten?
No, he's like an icon. Everybody knows about him.
Okay. All right. So, so John Adams, he's there, holding the ivory tower in some way of classical music against the monster invader pop culture. Now, we're going to begin with Zappa and his first media exposure. It's even before he has his album out. And as I talk, Roxy, if you notice I blip out, point it out to me, because I can't move at all. If I move slightly, it goes off. So, and sometimes I hear little clicks. So Zappa, as early as 1965, he is being interviewed for pop culture media, and he's engaging it, immediately. He's not saying, well, I'm a classical composer, and I don't want to hear about you people in the pop world, and I'm not going to acknowledge you. This is a a big deal in 1965-66, not only as a classical composer, but as a jazz musician, because I knew a composer, a musician professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax in the 70s, and we used to talk about Zappa, and he said as a young, he's probably the same age as Zappa, as a young person in the 50s, 60s, they did not take, he and his peers, serious musicians, they thought they were, did not take Elvis or rock and roll seriously. They were into jazz. So jazz was a big deal, and so he missed the genius of Zappa, he admitted to me, in the late 60s, early 70s, because he would not pay attention to pop music. So Zappa was also crossing the boundaries for his generation in from the jazz knowledge perspective, from the jazz ivory tower. You see what I'm saying? Not only just the classical.
Yes, he was a contemporary composer working in the framework of rock and roll. He always said that he knew he could not have exposure as a contemporary academic composer because he didn't want to limit himself to that type of classification or limitations of an audience and the type of music he could do. He wanted to do whatever he wanted to do.
Right. Now, here's a new aspect I'd add to it. That Zappa later said if he had not gone into music, he would have been a fantastic editor, you know, in Hollywood, in film. He has references to movies all the time. He tried to make a movie in the early 60s. It's like Zappa was not limited to being just a musician. When he talks about being a composer, he's talking about using all media. So that's another aspect about Frank, is that he was not just being a specialist in the world of music and loosening up these boundaries. He wasn't even specializing in being a musical artist. That's an important point.
No, he was more he had a series of ideas that he will also apply in his composition. Like, he saw, like, in the Finnegan's Wake, everything is happening all the time.
Yes.
And he had the phrase, anything, anytime, anywhere, for no reason at all.
Yeah.
And
Resonant with McLuhan's interpretation of the global theater that Zappa was growing up in and composing within. Now, I'm going to eventually emphasize that Zappa was not an acoustic artist, a visual artist, or kinetic artist. He was a tactile artist. And tactility is not a sense, but the interplay of all the senses. So this would explain why Zappa moved into any medium. And I want to...
I would like to say something. The name of his studio was the Utility Muffin Research Kitchen.
Right.
One of his later studios. He called his studio a kitchen. He was making food. And he was aware that we are feeding somehow not only the physical, but other aspects of our being. And he was making food. Acoustic food, tactile food, ideas. He always said there is this, there is always an idea, and around that is the music. So he was aware that it was not only beautiful melodies and rhythms, it was something else that is feeding us.
Other senses, all the senses. So you have an early statement by Zappa, and before we read his or look at some of his statements in his first interviews, and my thesis is that what he said later, a few years later, he already had planned back in 64, 65, before he even formed the Mothers of Invention. It says here in him describing the project object, he says it contains plans and non-plans, also precisely calculated event structures designed to accommodate the mechanics of fate and all bonus statistical improbabilities attendant thereto. Now, the second part is pretty important. He says, this whole project object incorporates any available visual medium, consciousness of all participants, including audience. So it's including consciousness. So that's either based on sensory analysis, a McLuhan-esque analysis of senses and extensions, or it means ESP. Consciousness is going to include consciousness of all participants, including the audience. He's going to include all perceptual deficiencies. In other words, he's not going to limit it to the pure ear or the pure eye or the pure kinesis or the pure proprioception. He's including all senses. And then he says it includes God, in brackets, as energy, and then it has dot, 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 and other things. Now, there may be a few other sentences, a few other nouns thrown in. I just found this one online. I didn't find the perfect statement, didn't have time, but maybe find the complete statement. But just to include any available visual medium and any available form of consciousness and any available perceptual deficiencies and any spiritual thing called God and other things, that is the perfect definition of the tactile perspective. The tactility is not a sense or an extension, but it absorbs and plays and interrelates and coheres everything as its content. So he's stating it right there. And, of course, if you're you're a tactile organ, the body that's providing the sensory data that tactility organizes has to be ready for what it does not foresee the body is going to engage, you know, perceptually. So that's why it would have plans and non-plans, and the accommodating of the mechanics of fate, which is like the preconditioning that comes in the sensory life, but also bonus statistical improbabilities. There's the non-physical attendant there too. You couldn't get a more comprehensive idea, updating of composing than that. And editing, being an editor.
Go ahead. He will compose every time he played his pieces. He was making it different for the audience, for the place, and he will squeeze the audience and the musicians not only to play notes, he will expect them to squeeze their instruments, every type of sound they could create, any type of noise. Right. They will expect them to act, to sing, and also the audience. It was like this participatory democracy. For him, that was very, very, very important, that he was in control, but he will let everybody express themselves, participate, and he will leave a space for the musicians to improvise and suggest things. He will have these hand signs to conduct, and they will just, for example, create the lowest note you can, and they will do some sound. And he will say, okay, like it or not, but sometimes live, this was improvised, and he will then take different versions of the different songs and mix them again. Because it was this non-stop creation. He said, like McLuhan, this continuous continuity, that everything all was one single creation. All his work, and at the end, everything humans are doing are part of this big Finnegan's creation.
Okay, let me add to that. The content, the participatory democracy, is the content of a tactile perspective. The tactile perspective would be more anticipatory democracy. That's what McLuhan called it, that we needed anticipatory, not participatory. Participatory was inevitably a knee-jerk response to the global theater, which demanded everybody to provide content 24/7 for all the media. So what would be the control tower of that? Well, Zappa tried to present himself as a control tower, but it has to include this huge flexibility and the apparent allowing of everybody to participate. But we learn from people like Foucault and other thinkers, the postmodern thinkers, that it's the trap set by the elites to allow everybody to have a say in everything. So I think Zappa was aware of that.
Maybe Corban could say something about how it was to play with Zappa.
Well, Corbin didn't play with Zappa. He was incredibly influenced. And let me just, you know, just bring Corbin in to say what he would say about that categorization of what he thought he was doing. Just a second. Okay, Corbin. I've unmuted you, Corbin. Did you ever play with Frank Zappa, Corbin? Corbin! I don't know, he fell asleep or something. But Corbin went to, you know, musical schools and was always learning Zappa stuff. He's very knowledgeable in Zappa music, but I don't know if he got to play with Tommy Mars or some of the musicians that live in the California area that Corbin hung out with over the last 25 years. So he's not responding, so sorry. We'll have to wait till he gets another opportunity. Now back to, we'll bring Corbin in eventually. So you were leading to what?
Yeah, we were talking about the anticipatory democracy.
Anticipatory, right. Now, to include consciousness of all sensory aspects of the audience and to include perceptual deficiency, there has to be a... you're not just allowing noise to be your content. You're going to shape it. Now, he and Don Van Vliet often regarded their music, and they influenced each other and their concepts about it very early, a form of sculpture. So sculpting the multimedia environment is what Zappa is doing and demonstrating the tactile perspective, the sculpting and shaping. Now, Zappa said, what else would we say there? He always made fun of the audience participation that he allowed in his concerts. He often, maybe not in every concert, but often he would go into what he called the audience participation phase of the program, and he'd say it almost sneeringly. It's not that he didn't enjoy their participation, but he always was split on the process. You'll see in my tiny note chart that he and McClune put on schizophrenia. He's including the controlling and duping of people as they get suckered into audience participation, but he's also knows its usefulness to provide content and keep the project object going. So it's an ambivalent, ambiguous relationship he has with that thing. But you'll notice if you ever hear it on albums and bootlegs, it's a bit of a put-on, the audience participation part. And so here is Frank trying to be a conductor, a classical controller of the symphony, at the same time allowing spontaneity. And that very dialectic of controlling and allowing is a good definition of tactility. He actually was acting out the tactile function, which is to organize the senses to create a coherent perception by the human being, but also knowing that you can't impose that control or that pattern on the human being. So it's just like McClune used to point out that the individual through the retina would reverse the world's image right there. You know, the data comes into the eye and the brain or some part of the perceptual apparatus would flip and turn the world upside down. Right there, the individual is persisting in its own perverted alteration of the sensory data. That's an example of the contradictory dialectical aspects of perception, which tactility includes. And so when Zappa has on Hot Rats, this movie for your ears... that totally fits with the fact that he's doing multimedia. Now, am I totally audible? I haven't been blipped out, right?
Yes.
No. Okay, good. So if you don't have anything more to say, you might have something to say. Go ahead if you do. I want to move into how Zappa began this with his first interviews, which were he considered part of his composition.
Yes,
anything that
everything he did was part of one big creation.
Well, and let's not say big creation.
He will reloop it and remix it, and he was always working on different.
Which is a tactile Tactile is always erasing what the data that's being presented to it. So it's not that he's making a big statement as, okay, this is the ultimate mathematical formula, this is the ultimate answer to everything. He was engaged in the process of shaping and sculpting. That's what was nonstop, which is what your brain does, or your perceptual apparatus.
Yes,
is that what you were trying to say?
Yes, that reminds me once you said Joyce will do the same.
Yes.
He was in this struggle when he was writing The Finnegan's Wake, that he was creating this amazing work, but he could not really see what he was doing or why.
Right.
And he was about to dismiss.
Which is what you have to be tactile, to make tactile art. But he being a talented singer and writer, it was a struggle for him to force himself to be tactile. You know, he had deliberate conditioning. He wasn't sure if this was the right approach, the correct approach for making significant art. So his struggle was the conflict of being tactile or miming tactility or the cognitive stages of apprehension. This is, and you know, Zappa's main question, who are the brain police, when Bob Marshall asked him that, you know, 1988, did he have an answer? Had he figured it out? He said in that interview, no, I'm still working on it. I'm still trying to figure out who the brain police are. And that's a natural tactile response, because tactility doesn't tell the difference between the chicken and the egg. You can't make a decision either side. So it's actually a tactile answer to say, and by definition, the laws of tactility, you have to say, I am still working on it. I'm still living, is what Zappa is saying. You don't come up with a definite answer. You present probes and aspects and satires and formulas, but they're all incomplete. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, the central scrutinizer.
The central scrutinizer is tactility itself.
He was working for Bob.
Well, that'll become obvious later, but not in these first programs. That's not obvious. So what I want to show you is, you know, he breaks up the Mothers of Invention in August 1969, but he'd already been planning to make this great movie, and he immediately went into talking about it as soon as the band broke up, and he went into trying to, you know, get the resources together. Now, he was working on it before the band broke up, and I think this is a Toronto Star article, maybe Globe and Mail, Toronto Globe and Mail, early 1969, and Zappa's talking to the rock columnist Richie York, who just surfaced recently with a new book on the John Lennon Yoko Ono peace campaign in 1969. Richie York got to be part of it because he was a friend of Ronnie Hawkins, who was the one sponsoring John Lennon playing in Toronto for the peace concert. And they traveled around the world, and Richie York got fired from his journalistic position at the Globe and Mail for traveling and being part of John Lennon's peace campaign, and so he went back to Australia, where he's from, and I guess he's been there for 40 years, but he surfaced recently with a book about his experience with John Yoko in that period in 69. Well, in that, before he got fired, he is a good journalist, an investigator of Zappa's work, and he did an interview with Zappa about the movie Uncle Meat, which goes into details that are not presented anywhere. And I've never seen this article in any of the Zappa archives, and they're really encyclopedic, these Zappa archives. But this article they missed, and it's always given me a clue to Frank of what he was doing and in relation to his father, because people bring up the question, well, okay, Frank was at the Army base, the chemical warfare factory in Baltimore, Maryland, when he was a young kid. During World War II, he grew up in the barracks with his father, who was a scientists working for the government, and the father brought home mercury, bags of mercury that the little child Frank Zappa played in, and some people think that's why Frank got sick later and then eventually had cancer. We just posted something on my Facebook page about that, that background, that question about Frank's health being around the secret chemical warfare plans in World War II outside of Baltimore. So with that in mind, listen to what how Frank is laying out a movie. Now, if you read some of the scripts of, you can get them here and there, of movies that Frank was making in 1963, 64, 65 with Captain Beefheart in Cucamonga, one of them's called Captain Beefheart versus the Grunt People. He's including rocket ship perspectives, you know, moon landings and things like that, as early as 62 and 63. So without further ado, let me just read what he says in the interview. It says, the mothers of invention are making a movie that will probably be the wildest thing since the, quote, the monster that swallowed Cleveland, unquote. After a stage career of squirting foam into front row seats, pounding a pick into a store display dummy, shouting obscenities at all and sundry, and creating mayhem in the pop scene, the mothers are producing a movie called Uncle Meat. And Frank Zappa, the main mother, says, quote, it's awful weird, unquote, which, coming from him, has frightening connotations. In Los Angeles this week, 28-year-old Zappa, a little less outspoken and a trifle more delicate than in the past, discussed Uncle Meat, and here's the quote. It's a surrealistic documentary about what the mothers do. Some footage has already been shot, such as some of the freakier things on our European tour, like the full-scale riot in Berlin. But that would be 1968, October 68, I think. But we haven't got to special effects, animation, and opticals as yet. We need more bread before getting into that. Unquote. Then Richie York says, and am I still coming through clear, Roxy? No.
Yeah.
Falling out. Okay. The mothers are still looking for $300,000 to finish the film. In hopes of raising even some of it, they decide to release the Uncle Meat soundtrack LP, a two-record set, on their own Bizarre label within a month. And that would be in the fall of 69. I mean, the spring of 69. So Richie York says, Zappa has been an aspiring movie maker for quite some time. Quote, frankly, man, I was struggling around trying to shoot a film 5 years ago. Then we formed the Mothers, and I had to put it aside for a while. But now I'm back into it, and it's taking up almost all of my time. So there he is. His big ambition is to make a movie in 62, composed with the movie medium in Los Angeles. He's done the soundtrack for Tim Carey's movie, The World's Greatest Sinner. That's in 63, I think the spring of 63. That comes out a week after Zappa is on the Steve Allen Show doing the Bicycle Symphony with Steve Allen and the band, this TV studio band. And many people, Zappa fans, have seen that footage. Well, that Zappa talks about Tim Carey's movie, The World's Greatest Sinner, you know, to Steve Allen, and here is Frank at the same time having his own ambitions to make a movie. So, and you can get a script of this early stuff, Captain Beefheart versus the Grunt People, or maybe had another name in that period, 63. But here he is, 5 years later, saying, it'll represent us in the most illogical sense. Sometimes it will deal with the god-awful things people expect of us, their worst possible thoughts. Now, that would be awareness of the audience's thoughts, right? Consciousness. But what they think we'll do and what we do are two very different things. Then he goes, sometimes. You see the indecision, the discontinuous, the not even being specific about what he's saying, that he's attempting to be specific about. And sometimes it'll be not what you think we're going to do. So let me read that again. Richie York says, Uncle Meat will contain a mixture of comedy and satire. So Richie York thinks this is comedy and satire. He doesn't recognize the physics of it, the science part of Frank. that's happening here. Well, nobody would, but we know a lot more about Frank and now, and we can project that back there. So he is purposely saying, I'm going to present the mothers in a way that they aren't apparently visibly doing. We're going to present them in an illogical sense. Now, already the mothers are discontinuous and nonlinear. So why would he present them, like squaring the discontinuity again to present them illogically? Have you any thoughts about that right off the start here?
Well, I think it's a modern phenomenon, like Wilhelm Lewis being quadrophrenic and saying he's a socialist, fascist, and fascist, and a monarchist.
Monarchist and an anarchist.
Mark Twain saying he disagrees with what he said, or if he talks
right.
about something, it's because he disagrees with that, or he's not promoting what he's talking about.
And right.
It's all these things going on that you can just change your angle and change your arrogant opinion.
Yeah, halfway through the sentence.
Yes.
You would even deny you were quadriphenic if you had the term. Okay, so he says, I'll represent the mothers in the most illogical sense. Sometimes he will deal with the god-awfulest things people expect of us. So he knows he's popular because they do a weird show, and it's not normal. And people expect this weirdness from Frank. And Frank is saying, I'm not about that all the time. You know what I mean?
Yes,
the god-awfulest things people...
One way he will translate that, he will make quotes of music he hated or he found
yes.
stupid, like romantic music, these type of songs, cheesy songs. He